Good afternoon. Welcome to the Healthy Aging Show. I'm Dennis Batuas.
I'm Dawn Del Greco.
And we are going to be talking about issues about getting older, intelligent aging, lessons for life. And we're brought to you by Comfort Keepers, where everywhere in the United States, anywhere that someone needs help, 600 locations, we provide non-medical in-home care. We do it with a smile. We do it well. We help you stay in your own home.
But Dennis, we even help you when we're not there.
How do we do that?
With the Staying Independent program.
Oh, yeah.
We have a
personal monitoring system that we also have. It's a proprietary product that's marketed by Comfort Keepers.
We have with us Dr. Alan Radin, who is with Arbor Medical Group in Wilton, Connecticut. And he is a general internist, very knowledgeable in the area of COPD. I didn't realize that there are 16 million people that have chronic obstructive pulmonary disease.
I didn't realize that either. That's a much larger number. But part of the research, Dr. Radin, that we were looking at said that there's even more.
That's right. It's estimated that that's only half of the people that have COPD.
Now, what exactly is COPD? I think a lot of us don't fully understand. We know the initials. We hear it frequently. But what does it actually mean?
Okay, so COPD stands for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. So chronic means that it's a long-lasting disease. It spans decades. And it's a lung disease, pulmonary is lung disease. Obstruction implies that it's an obstruction to the flow of air in and out of the lungs. COPD is actually sort of an umbrella term for two diseases, chronic bronchitis and emphysema. Most people think of when they think of emphysema, they're really talking about COPD and chronic bronchitis rather than the actual pathologic definition of emphysema.
But each disease or each of those conditions affects a different part of the breathing system.
Yes. Chronic bronchitis implies that the problems in the bronchial tubes and the air passages in particular, they're inflamed, they're narrowed, in some cases destroyed by whatever is causing the COPD. Emphysema is more destruction of the alveoli. Those are the tiny air sacs that are at the end of a respiratory tree. So if you look at a lung that has emphysema, there are large holes or gaps in the lung tissue itself.
So that means the top and the bottom, generally speaking, with a lung?
I'm sorry.
Because the bronchitis is typically a little higher up in the structure, right?
The chronic bronchitis affects the air passages, the tubes that go from the... You have the trachea that carries air from the nose and mouth down into the lungs, and then it divides and divides and divides and divides as it goes through the lung, and those are the bronchial tubes. That's the part that's affected most in chronic bronchitis.
So it's also all those little straws that come out of the balloon that provides the air that comes
exactly.
out of your mouth.
See? Exactly.
See? Okay, we really simplified
it. Now even Dawn
it
understands it.
Now, this is something that is 80 to 90% caused by smoking?
Yes. The British call this smoker's lung disease. There are a couple of other causes. There's a hereditary cause called alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, and that's an enzyme that's missing in the lung. It's a genetic disorder, and it causes an identical form of emphysema to the kind that can be caused by smoking. And then there are some people who get it because of exposure to a variety of toxins, industrial toxins in particular, that can damage the lung. But the vast majority of COPD is caused by smoke.
So it's a self-inflicted disease?
Yes.
In most cases?
Yes.
And it's not curable?
It's not curable, but it is treatable.
So the symptoms can be relieved or stabilized, but we can't turn it back.
No, but early on, when you have very, very, very mild disease, if you stop smoking, which is the number one treatment for this disease, if you stop smoking, you can preserve lung function. And if it's early enough, then it'll preserve at pretty much the normal level, with a very, very slight decrement. Any time along the path of disease that you stop smoking, you improve lung function.
Now, what would be some of the initial symptoms that we may not recognize?
Well, the one that most people would think about is a cough, the so-called smoker's cough. That's often early chronic bronchitis. That's part of the origin or the early part of the disease. Before that, people may actually have changed their exercise habits, other activities, in order to accommodate a very subtle change in their exercise ability, so that they're not able to play, let's say, a full set of singles tennis. They're not able to climb stairs like they used to. Maybe they can climb one flight, but not a second flight. Maybe they can't even climb the first flight without sort of running out of breath. So without even thinking about it, they switch to taking the elevator, they switch to playing doubles tennis, or limiting that activity, or exercising less. And sometimes they don't even recognize that they've made a change in their lifestyle to accommodate a very subtle change in breathing. Then the cough and phlegm production begins, and that's a telltale sign that they're in trouble.
I was interesting because the phlegm is a barometer that you use to determine many different types of breathing issues.
Right, but the history here is one of a smoker who has a smoker's cough or who actually presents to the doctor, let's say, two or three times during the year with an acute bronchitis. The story that we hear sometimes is every time I get a cold, it goes into my chest. And if that combined with a smoker, you have to be very suspicious that they have early COPD.
Quick question. What about acid reflux?
Well, acid reflux is a whole different disease, and it really doesn't play a role. It is a cause in some people of chronic cough. It's usually a dry cough rather than a moist, phlegmy cough. But
Does it cause a bronchitis?
Not usually.
It doesn't. Okay.
Now, if you've been a former smoker and you've quit smoking or are thinking of quitting smoking, you can certainly get off this course, right?
Exactly. Your lung function, if you stop smoking, then can improve. All of us, as we age, lose lung function at a certain fixed rate, and that goes on throughout our entire life until the end. And there are graphs that have been developed over the years that show what a normal lung function is at any particular age. Most smokers will have a reduction in that lung function as they get older. If you stop smoking, the rate of decline goes back to the normal population for most people.
That's good news.
That's very good news, especially if you stop early enough so that the lung function is not interfering very much with your life.
So there's truth in the story that your lungs regain the pink, become healthy once again.
Well, you don't go back to normal. You'd simply decline at the normal rate so that you don't necessarily, very early, if you quit very early, you may be lucky enough to go back to a normal number. But for most people, once there's decline, the decline will, you'll have diminished lung function by a certain percentage. And then the rate of decline after that, how much you lose each year, goes back to the normal rate of decline rather than an accelerated rate of decline, which is associated with smoking.
Now, how do you actually diagnose this? Is this x-rays? What's used in that process?
Okay, the most important part of the diagnosis is the history. That is, you're talking to people, finding out that they're smoking, asking a patient whether they smoke or not. That's the first most important key to this, and then the symptoms of whether they have shortness of breath, whether they have the smoker's cough, whether they wake up in the morning and have to clear out their lungs from phlegm that they've accumulated overnight, whether they've changed their exercise habits or their exercise ability or their daily schedule because of shortness of breath, or for whatever reason they may not recognize that it's short of breath. The key diagnostic test is not really x-ray. The key diagnostic test is called spirometry, where you breathe into a machine and measure the flow rates and the amounts of air that you can move in toto, how much air, you know, what's the maximum amount of air you can move in and out of your lungs, and how fast can you do it. And there are a variety of measurements that are made of those rates, and that's the key test to tell us whether or not there's obstructive pulmonary disease. That, with the history, and probably at that point a normal chest x-ray or a chest x-ray that shows a little bit too much air in the chest, that is air that can't get out because there's obstruction to flow, pretty much clinches the diagnosis.
Now, with the exercise that's suggested, what's the range of that? Because very often when you hear exercise, you see someone taking their family member out to the gymnasium and running them through the circuit. How much exercise is appropriate?
Well, the general, leaving aside any other illnesses, because a lot of smokers will also have heart disease, they may have other comorbidities, but just speaking about COPD itself, there really isn't much of a limit on exercise. Usually we tell people that they can exercise as long as they can speak a sentence, and a sentence should be a few words long, not just the word help, but a few word sentence. If they can speak that without distress, then that's an okay level of exercise.
Once someone develops COPD, there's a spiral that follows that affects other body parts and the functionality of their quality of life. Because we're dependent upon oxygen to muscles and different parts of the body, what are some of the other side effects that go beyond just the breathing inability?
Well, COPD, we stage COPD from mild to severe, really four stages that have been outlined from very mild, almost asymptomatic disease without symptoms, to mildly symptomatic disease, worse, and then severe. So the oxygen levels in the blood usually do not fall until you're out at severe disease. There's a lot of reserve pulmonary function. So oxygen deprivation is really not an issue until you have quite severe disease, and then it's pretty obvious, frankly. In the earlier diseases, probably less other organ dysfunction due to the COPD, but if there's continued smoking, then you have problems with heart disease in particular, so that heart disease, congestive heart failure, stroke, and ultimately lung cancer, all are things that are associated with the cigarette smoking part of things rather than the COPD by itself. When you're out late in the disease with COPD, then oxygen levels fall, supplemental oxygen is often necessary. You can see changes in thinking when people get oxygen deprived. It, of course, stresses their heart, so heart disease as a consequence of that, is fairly common.
Now, are we possibly being diagnosed earlier in our maturity, in our age groups?
Well, I'd like to say so, but I don't think that that's really the case. There's a huge lag in the diagnosis. Like we said in the beginning, probably half of the people with COPD are undiagnosed. Mm-hmm. That comes from a variety of places, both because patients sometimes don't talk about their smoking history and it doesn't come out. It's been so difficult to get people to stop smoking. Some doctors have become very nihilistic about it, they look at it and say, well, there's nothing I'm going to do, and there's no sense, spending a lot of time talking about this because the person's going to continue to smoke and they're going to continue to get ill. There are some people who, because this is a self-afflicted disease, kind of take a negative attitude toward early diagnosis and treatment, but it would help if people were diagnosed much sooner and would help if doctors and the public were more vigorous about stopping smoking.
And that's starting.
Are we seeing an increase in the number of diagnoses made? And my thought is that as people age longer, more and more things will be happening that are afflicting them. And as with other diseases that we're seeing, sometimes we're seeing an increase because we're living longer, acquiring these ailments.
Well, there's no question that there are more people now that have COPD because of that, because the population is aging. The people have had a longer time to, the smokers have had a longer time to smoke. It takes about 10 years of smoking to really start to develop this disease in a classic sense. So we undoubtedly, there are more people. And I suppose that then there are more people being diagnosed. I don't really know the statistics on that.
Yeah, I was a smoker, and I stopped 35 years ago. But I smoked three packs a day for about 10 years. So I don't consider myself clear of risk. Or should I consider myself clear of risk after that? Can I please?
As long as you're alive, you're never clear of risk.
We'll be right back with Dr. Alan Radin on COPD. Welcome back. We're talking with Dr. Alan Radin about COPD and the effects of smoking.
Yeah, there's a lot of controversy about that, actually, because the classic teaching was that after 10 years of being free of cigarette smoke, that the risk of lung cancer then goes back to the risk in the general population, which is very low. There is lung cancer among non-smokers, but it's not that common. It's very unusual. The people have looked at some of that data now and said, well, maybe it's not 10 years. Maybe there is some increased risk that goes forward after that. It obviously goes down considerably after a decade, but there may be some risk. As far as COPD is concerned, whatever damage was done, and at this point, I don't think that would be an issue for you. If you had spirometry, you might see that your lungs were not as good as an age-matched control.
Well, I had
spirometry
about a year ago, and I was fine.
Good.
I do very well with that, Dennis,
because
I talk a lot.
With the word or with the test?
Spirometry and the test.
Every smoker gets COPD. It's hard to, and we don't really know why some do and some don't. There may be some genetic predisposition to that. but not every smoker, let's say every person who smoked 3 packs a day for 10 years, gets COPD. And of course, if the spirometry now has been so long after the smoking, you may have recovered enough lung function to, that is, your peers, your age match peers, may have lost enough lung function to have caught up with you, and so it's normal for age. One of the things that some spirometers do is to calculate what's called a lung age. And what that does basically is says, okay, this is your lung function. It would be normal if you were such and such years old. So in my practice, I have a 50-year-old man who's a pack-a-day or pack-and-a-half-a-day smoker. His lung age is 80. Ooh. That is, it'd be normal if he was 80 years old. I use that to help to motivate people to stop smoking, because I tell them, look, if your lungs are 80 years old, how long do you think they're going to live?
Exactly.
Right.
So that's lung age is one of the ways that you can translate all this spirometry data into something that really hits home, very understandable and very emotional.
So, Dennis, are you playing doubles tennis or single?
Well, I'm playing doubles, but only because the guy that I played singles with beats me all the time.
Right.
Right.
Now, what about diet tips? What do we do as far as nutrition?
Okay, so diet, well, first of all, through most of the stages of COPD where people are not terribly hampered by the lung disease, you want to have a healthy diet anyway, because you want to avoid heart disease and all the other things that that diet can help you. As you get into the more severe parts of COPD, there are some dietary changes that can be made to reduce the carbohydrate load that a person takes. Carbohydrates get metabolized to carbon dioxide and water. Oh. And the carbon dioxide is released from the body through the lungs. And one of the problems that people with COPD have is getting rid of that carbon dioxide. And then that affects their body acidity and other things. It can be a huge challenge. So we try to reduce carbohydrates. It's one of the places, one of the few places in medicine where we actually increase fats in the diet and reduce carbohydrates to help people to reduce that CO2 load, the carbon dioxide load, and make it a little easier for them. Maintaining a normal weight is important. Obviously, if your lungs aren't working well and you're very overweight, you have a double problem in terms of exercise ability. And of course, if you have severe enough COPD, then it becomes difficult to exercise, becomes easier to sit on the couch, and so weight control becomes even more difficult.
Well, in preparation for this interview, we went back and we did some research and found a paper that was published by John Hopkins University, or John Hopkins Health Alerts, actually. And they were talking about, at the later stages, how many COPD patients are malnourished.
Right.
Because the effort to eat is such, and the effort to breathe uses so many calories, that you have two negative things happening that diminishes
the enjoyment of eating.
Well you have an enormous problem in late-stage COPD. Mm-hmm. First of all, you adults cannot breathe and eat at the same time.
Infants can.
Yeah, we could try. But infants can do that. Infants can nurse on a bottle or a breast and never stop while they're breathing. But we lose that very soon in our infancy. And as an adult, you have to stop breathing to swallow your food, and then you swallow food and start breathing. So if you're short of breath to start with, all that time that you're taking to swallow and to stop breathing is a difficult thing to do to start with. And then, you're right, there's an additional calorie expenditure simply for breathing. And then everything that you do, getting up from the couch to go to the bathroom, takes much more work and much more energy than it would if you were fit. People late stage, because they are getting malnourished, tend to lose lean body mass, meaning they lose bone and muscle. So if you're losing muscle, you become weaker, and then that adds to that. These are not only arm and leg muscles and back muscles that would help you walk across the room, but also the respiratory muscles, the muscles in the ribs, the muscles of the diaphragm also are lost. So there's weakness, and this is part of that spiral that you mentioned before. Bad breathing, bad eating, more weakness. More weakness makes for more difficulty breathing, and it just keeps on going down unless you can intervene and make some changes.
So that's
very late stage disease.
So they kind of wither away.
They do, but they wither away. People at that stage tend to be in and out of the hospital with COPD exacerbations or pulmonary infections. So they often have a sort of a revolving door relationship with a hospital. Be in for a week or two, out for a month or two or three or four, back in the hospital with another exacerbation. And each of these exacerbations takes a toll on their lung function and on their overall health and on their emotional health. It really is very depressing.
It has to be very depressing.
Yeah. And they're probably more vulnerable, too, with the flu season, et cetera, with the wintertime.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. We try to emphasize that everyone with lung disease, whether it be asthma, COPD, or any of the other pulmonary diseases, get immunized, make sure that they have annual flu vaccines and then also the pneumonia vaccine to make sure that as best they can, they prevent preventable illness.
We're going to take a break. We're talking with Dr. Alan Radin about COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and right now about the pneumonia vaccine. Be right back. We're back. We're talking with Dr. Alan Radin, and the subject now is COPD and pneumonia vaccines.
We found, I think we continue to find, that many people don't know about the pneumonia vaccine. And for one thing, it's probably because the regular flu vaccine is given annually, and the pneumonia vaccine is every 5 years or twice in a lifetime, I believe.
Right. If you get flu vaccine, if you get pneumonia vaccine after the age of 65, you only need one dose. If it's given earlier than 65, then it's boosted in 5 years and then boosted again once after you're 65. We generally don't use much pneumonia vaccine under the age of 65 unless a person has a chronic illness which would make them more vulnerable to pneumonia, heart disease, diabetes, or any pulmonary disease. Well, those people ought to have pneumonia vaccine. After the age of 65, it's recommended that everyone get pneumonia vaccine. And this is pneumococcal pneumonia. It's one form of pneumonia. It's the most common bacterial pneumonia that we have, but it's that one form. It doesn't protect against all pneumonias.
Is it fair to say that pneumonia is one of the contributing factors to death of people that have COPD?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. People with COPD die of pulmonary infections, oftentimes because they've been in and out of hospitals where there are, you know, pretty aggressive bacteria these days, resistant bacteria. So they frequently will have a more difficult pneumonia to treat. They've been in and out. They're weak. They have other illnesses. So pneumonia is certainly one of the end-stage diseases. And then also at that point, most of the people will have some heart disease. So that's another, you know, end-stage or end event.
Well, I know that Don wants to talk about cures or possible treatments, but I did have one other thing that I wanted to ask about.
Okay, Dennis. And it's your show.
Thanks. Oh, no, that was just that in my reading, I noticed that, and they said, surprisingly, COPD is a progressive disorder that cannot be cured, but older adults report fewer and less severe symptoms than younger ones. And they attributed that to a more sedentary lifestyle. What was the other reason that they...
I don't know, Dennis.
You didn't read the article.
That's...
Oh, second, they tend to grow accustomed to their symptoms and may restrict their activities to avoid them. So I guess younger people become
We're just impatient, Dennis. That's what it is. Okay. We younger people than you older people. Any new treatments on the horizon?
Well... why don't I talk about the treatments that are available now?
Okay.
So number one, beyond anything else, is stopping smoking. And there are a variety of ways that can occur. Some people just decide they're going to do it, and they go cold turkey, and they just get rid of the cigarettes, and that's the end of it. Others use some of the organizations, Smokers Anonymous, Smoke Enders. The hospitals in the area all have smoking programs or stop smoking programs to help people. There are medications that can be prescribed to help people avoid some of the cravings that can occur with smoking, because smoking is a nicotine addiction. It's an addiction to nicotine, and it's a very, very, very difficult addiction to break. So it often requires some help, whether it's through a group, whether it's some people do it with hypnosis, some people can do it themselves, and some people require medication. There's nicotine substitution in a variety of forms that is available, whether it be patch or gum or lozenge or sprays. So there are a variety of ways to help. It's very important for people to keep at it. If they fail one method, go to a second method. If they need to do it 10 times, that's fine. The national statistic is that it takes over 3 attempts to actually become a non-smoker. But if it takes 4, if it takes 5, whatever it takes, this is a life-saving maneuver. You know, it should be encouraged constantly by family, doctors, everybody. So that's number one. That's the most important thing. Nobody can beat the cigarette. The treatment for the disease, beyond that, you know, sort of general health measures, good diet, exercise, and such. And then there are inhalers. There are medications that can be used to help improve the lung function, to open up the bronchial tubes, which are now constricted by inflammation. Medications sometimes that are used to relieve some of that inflammation, inhaled medication to relieve some of the medications. So bronchodilators and inhaled medications to reduce inflammation are the mainstay therapeutic maneuvers that we have. Later on, we might add oxygen in late-stage disease, and there are certain criteria for doing that. Exacerbations, which are is an increase in the amount of sputum and the shortness of breath and the cough that people have, looks like an infection, like an acute bronchitis, then a person might get antibiotics. They might get oral steroid medications, prednisone, anti-inflammatory medicine, to help quell that acute attack. And then there's pulmonary rehabilitation, which is an exercise program and a program to teach people pulmonary methods for breathing better, for helping to relieve some of their shortness of breath. And that's available locally at the hospitals. At Norwalk Hospital has one of the premier pulmonary rehab programs in the country, and an early one that started very early and has a very excellent reputation. And so that can help people function despite the fact that they have the disease and perhaps are on treatment with some of the inhalers, but still need some help in their life.
So we can be comfortable then.
There was an article that I also picked up from John Hopkins that talked about erectile dysfunction medicines as being tested as a treatment for COPD. Is that something that you're familiar with?
Yeah, it hasn't really panned out very very well. There was a recent article about that because it's been used in a different pulmonary disease, pulmonary hypertension, which has to do with the vascular supply to the lungs, and it's been used successfully there, but in COPD so far hasn't really panned out.
And then there was something else where they would perforate the air sacs?
Well, there are some surgical treatments for severe COPD. One is lung reduction surgery, which sounds counterintuitive that you would take out a piece of the lung in somebody that doesn't have enough lung function, but they take out part of the lung that is not functioning but is inhibiting the function of other parts of the lungs. A simple way to look at it. And
Makes sense.
And that helps some people. There's a bit of controversy of who is best served by that therapy. This is end-stage disease. This is people that have a hard time getting around their homes. They're on oxygen. This is a very end-stage disease. Most people with COPD, the vast majority, are not at that stage. They're at the stage where they're walking down the street and coughing every now and then.
Right. How did you get into this?
Some years ago, one of the pharmaceutical companies that produces one of the COPD medications contacted me. They put together an interesting program. They had half of a panel of nationally known COPD experts, and half the group were primary care physicians. This was called the National COPD Awareness Council. The purpose was to try to translate advanced knowledge about COPD that the pulmonologists would have and the bench knowledge to primary care docs, and how best to get that word out, how best to educate the primary care community, which sees the most of the patients with COPD, and virtually all of the patients with early COPD are seen by their family doctors, their gynecologists, or their internists. So we worked for years, actually, and published a number of papers trying to bring that knowledge to primary care docs in a way that was feasible and reasonable for the way primary care is practiced all over the place. You know, short 15-minute visit, looking at the way patients present to us rather than the pulmonary specialists who are seeing patients in university clinics with advanced disease. I got interested in it.
You see the lion's share of people that are suffering from this.
Absolutely. We see all of the disease where intervention would make a huge difference. If we can get, you know, that 25-year-old smoker who now is mostly women, if you can get that 25-year-old smoker to stop smoking, you've saved somebody incredible misery. And we see those patients. The university pulmonologist doesn't see those patients. They see them when they're 60, 70 years old, and they're short of breath.
after everything that we know about smoking?
Well, the problem with smoking, it's a rising problem amongst young girls for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is weight control. But that's where the growth in cigarette smoking is, and where the growth in COPD is.
Now, Dr. Radin, as the year progresses, if you have any lectures or presentations out in the community, please let us know.
I sure will.
And we will announce that.
We want to give a little bit of contact information to reach Dr. Radin. Again, he's with the Arbor Medical Group, which is in Wilton, Connecticut, and his phone number is
203-762-3353.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
We will draw upon you in the future, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Sure. Please subscribe, recommend, and visit our website, healthyagingshow.com. Thanks for joining us at the Healthy Aging Show.